super pumped to be here for another episode. And today I've got a good friend of mine, Brian Humphreys, who's a former Air Force officer, a guy that adopted three kids and had another kid all in 6 months. So he's a super rock star there. He lays down some great advice about military transition, lessons learning when you're in, when you get out, how to apply those in the civilian world, and also some lessons he picked up while being an executive and then becoming like an innovator on the ground, getting his hands dirty and having some fun making some change, even throwing some bureaucracy in there. And maybe it's not a bad thing. So, Brian, super excited to have you here. Welcome, man.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Looking forward to our talk.
Yeah.
So I started out as an officer in the Air Force as an aircraft maintenance officer. And that community is a lot of fun. You get to be really close to the mission. Also, high stress. People can die if stuff goes the wrong way. So I really enjoyed it. Really good leadership experience. I think my favorite part was just getting to work with some really, really shit hot senior enlisted leaders that have been around the block. Knew what they were doing, leading people, and that were willing to take a young lieutenant under their wing and teach them the ropes. That's probably the highlight from a maintenance perspective, is just the people you get to work with and the mission you get to touch. And then I also got to spend some time in the acquisition world, which, as you alluded to, some of that was as an exec for Mr. Wirt, who's a SES up there in Boston, running PEO Digital. And that was a really cool experience. I saw Kessel Run forming from afar, and that was the year that everything with AOC 10-2 transitioning into Kessel Run as a path forward for that program. And then after that, I got to jump in and get my hands dirty with Mad Hatter, working on the F-35 logistics software. Got some good software experience as a product manager type, and then got to see what it was like to innovate at that scale, which is really exciting. And then I had a couple other assignments in aircraft maintenance on the F-35. And then now I'm actually working at Clarity as a program manager, Clarity Innovations, which is all about mission, all about people. And I get to be still part of what the Air Force is doing day to day. So really exciting place to be.
That's pretty awesome. And from any standpoint, you've had a pretty cool career and you've got to be involved in some pretty cool stuff. But you've also created a pretty, what I would call, respectable and cool home life. Like you and your wife give back more than anyone I've ever met. Talking about that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So my wife and I, when we were stationed in Arkansas, we showed up with zero kids and bought a 4-bedroom house because we're here a few years, we'll start filling it out. Lo and behold, things didn't work out for us biologically. And so we ended up getting into foster care, and we had three empty bedrooms and this group of three kids needed a home. So we're like, why not? Let's jump in. And so we jumped in and made it. It was a wild ride, especially the first year. We transitioned from that assignment up to Boston, having adopted those kids. And then we had our biological son, the fourth one, like 3 months before we PCS up to Hanscom. So we went from zero to four kids in 6 months, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone, but we've survived. And I'll tell you, of all the experience that I've had or that my wife has had, parenting has been the most humbling for sure, but also rewarding.
Definitely. Well, I love pulling that thread because I know there's so much, we've focused on so much on the workspace and things we're doing and the hustle, but a lot of people go home and relax and chill. And you chose to do it a little bit differently, where you gave everything you have on both fronts, which I know a lot of parents do, but from taking on, doing what you guys did for those kids in such a short time I love that part of you. And, but back to your other side. So you're doing all these things. Give me something that you learned from, what stands out from your time as, whether it's at Kessel Run, whether it's as you're flying the wall to an innovator type thing, what stands out there?
Yeah. So one of the things that fascinated me when I was the exec for Mr. Wirt was he is a very innovative person and how innovative senior leaders can be. And this is when it started to hit me what the frozen middle was and why they exist. Because on the one hand, senior leaders are really innovative. And on the other hand, they're also holding people accountable for execution. And so, because they're responsible for execution. So it creates this weird tension where junior level leaders when you're talking at like the SES or general officer level, the junior level leaders are all colonels who are trying to make a name for themselves and don't want to be the face of failure to an organization. And that creates a culture where it's really difficult to innovate because these are very successful people. They've gotten to where they are because they've been the best of the best. And now you're trying to find the number one best of the best of 15 bests, right? And so it's really competitive. And as much as they can keep things collegial, it's still really competitive. And that, I think, creates this hesitation to, even when you have the senior leader who's saying, go innovate, go fail fast, go do cool things, there's still some hesitation because of the repercussions. Even if it's something like, hey, not that you get schwacked for doing something wrong, but you're not the number one guy now because you didn't win and you took a risk and it didn't work out. So that's one thing. And then I think another really interesting piece to me was just how much networking is needed, right? Like, even at that level where, you know, I hope Mr. Word doesn't mind me name dropping him a bunch, but like at his level, he's the PEO signing authority for 150 programs. But even at his level, he's got to network with the right stakeholders on the requirements side and the right stakeholders on the contractor side to make sure that whatever acquisition approach we're taking actually makes sense and meets the needs of the end user, the warfighter. So I was just floored at how much networking goes on and how important relationships are. I've always heard that, but I think that's really the first place that I saw it in person.
I love that. And that's how we met.
Yes.
Yeah. It's through networking conversations.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And so I think it's love about that piece is how the value of networking with the right people, because I believe for me, I was never a kid that could stranger danger worked on because strangers just friends I haven't met yet. So my mom always got mad at me, but as adults now in the career space, it's people seem to network just to gain something. And they only seem to do it just, I have to talk to that person because they can give me something. And that matters. Like you said, like you need to know from whatever role you may be in, who you have to work with and partner with. But there's also the way that you and I met where it was just, we met because you were next to Jay, who I know Jay, and we called you. And it was, we weren't trying to get anything from each other. It was just the fun conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both are necessary, right? Like you're gonna have some people you just run into and meet and something kind of natural happens. And then you'll have people that you're going to have to call them because it's your job to do whatever with them, get whatever mission outcome with them. And I think one thing that's important is, you know, I remember this one time we had a meeting with a particular requirement lead and it was a 1-star general. And this is a 2-star that I was in the meeting with. And he's basically the 1-star starts filming off on him. And he's like, hey, you're way out of line. You guys are just really unprofessional. And his leader just let it go and just finished the meeting up. And was like, all right, we'll figure out what we can do and we'll get back with you. And so after the meeting, I asked him like, why didn't you schwack this guy? I'm from the maintenance world where you don't tolerate that kind of public disrespect for people, right? You throw down and let's go. And he was just like, well, let's say I put him in his place. What did that do for the relationship moving forward? And that was a big aha moment for me that he had the long game in mind and was thinking about the next 1-2 steps. And he knew that eventually this guy was going to see that we were in the right and everything was fine, but he kept the political capital in the bank because he didn't want to spend it on a power play. So that I think is key too. Like just keeping in mind that, because there's a lot of type A's in this space, right? There's a lot of people who want to be right, but just like in marriage, sometimes you can be right and still be wrong. You can still lose even if you win the argument. You can take that to an extreme in the wrong direction, but I think it's a good thing to keep in mind.
So I'm guessing, because I think you're at home right now, if it gets extreme at your house, do you use that sword behind you? You get a sword fight?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's just to dub them, you know, when they leave the house, I'll dub them as Knights of the Humphreys Order. Something like that.
Get out. You can't return.
Yeah, get on out of here. You're welcome back for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and that's it.
I really love that story, that lesson, because it is human nature to react and defend and even if you're not a type A. So that's a really good lesson to learn. Let's pull back a little bit when we're talking about Mad Hatter. So I know what Mad Hatter is, but what is Mad Hatter? Because it's a pretty cool project, or in your words, you had fun. Walk us through that experience, both kind of what is it and your involvement in it all.
Yeah, definitely. So this was an interesting project that came up while I was sitting up as an exec. And we had Dr. Roper, who is the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for acquisition. He heard about Kessel Run. He heard about good things that were happening up there. And he was like, hey, basically met with Mr. Wirt. He said, hey, I've got this problem with the F-35 program that no one's really paying much attention to. And it's ALICE, which is logistics software. And you say logistics software and it's okay, well, what does that mean? It's everything from ordering parts to keeping track of the aircraft configuration to holding the work order, like the tech manuals that the maintainers use to do maintenance, pilot scheduling, training, like everything you could think of to run an aircraft program was tied up into this ALICE. And let's just say that it needed a lot of work. And so Dr. Roper brought in Kessel Run to help. And that was actually a place where I got to go with Matt Nelson out to Luke Air Force Base, which is the biggest, I think it's still the biggest F-35 base in the world, over 100 aircraft there. But we went out and we just said, hey, what can we do? How would we approach this problem with the user-centered design and agile software development approach? And we wrote up this report and we were like, hey, it was like a 10-page report. This is what we think we could do. This is how we would approach it. And then we sent that back up through the channels to Dr. Roper. And then it was several months that went by just working through all the politics of, as you can imagine, in a program that size, there's a ton of processes in place and bureaucracy. And I don't know all the things that went into getting us onboarded, but eventually we got to a point where it was like, all right, we're going to kick off this project. And our goal was to take ALICE, the legacy system, which is, it's ALIS, Autonomic Logistics Information System, and use a strangler pattern approach, eat the elephant one bite at a time to get some working software, joyful software into the hands of the users, the aircraft maintainers out there. So Mad Hatter was a play on words like Alice in Wonderland. And the further you got into Alice, the more it felt like you're in Wonderland a little bit. But yeah, so that was Mad Hatter. And so it was really exciting because I had several moments where I was an exec and people would come in and brief and they were doing all these exciting things. And I was like, I wonder if I could do that. Because you get so used to pushing paperwork and hearing about stuff that's happening, but you don't really feel like a doer. It was so exciting to go from that into being an actual doer. And we built that team out from just the two of us to eventually it was 80 folks by the time I left less than a year later. And you know, it was a lot of fun. Like we didn't get after all the outcomes that we wanted to, because there were some other politics at play and some technical limitations. I think we did help push the program forward and help the F-35 community show some investment in the aircraft maintainers, which went a long way. Yeah.
How was it received when you guys went out and did your UX human center design project? Because even now that's still not super accepted to like people walking around asking questions.
Yeah. We had a big scoping session. I forget what they called it, but yeah, it was we had Pivotal Labs at the time that came on, or Pivotal that came on to help with the architecture effort and with the software redesign in FTX. And so we did this big, like took a week and we laid out several of those long sheets of paper and just brought users in four or five at a time, sometimes one at a time, depending on the structure or like what we were talking about. And we just said, all right, let's map out this whole process of launching an airplane from 0-100 in the morning to 2400 at night and what all goes into that. And it was, the maintainers were really excited about it. And then it was the challenge of, okay, this is what we've got, a big picture of what the elephant is and what the pains are. How are we going to then go and attack this? And then we took that and used a domain-driven design approach to chunk the system into different sections of similar capability. And then we would spin up a team that would then go out and do the discovery and framing in that space. So like we had a team that was doing scheduling and they went out and did a DNF and did lots of user interviews and what's your current process. That was all really well received. I think the challenge to do it right is always like having someone who's not just the user on the ground, but who also has that senior perspective, who understands not just what I want the button to look like, but what outcome that button needs to achieve, if that makes sense. And I think we had that pretty well with Mad Hatter, because we had a lot of involvement from the senior level within the organization. But yeah, I think by and large, user-centered design was well received. It's more that I worry about how some of those people perceive it after the fact, because Mad Hatter itself didn't really get across the finish line. But it was a good process to use at the time.
That's the world of innovation, right? And the world that people think, oh, it's got the support, it's got the things, but not everything makes it. And you take that and you learn and you keep going to the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And that was where the first time you started working with Matt Nelson, you sounded like too.
Yep.
Yeah. Another bro in our group text.
Yeah. Yeah. The bro of all bro. No, he's awesome. Yeah. He was, we were the two guys starting out on that project, and then he eventually got pulled into some other stuff for Big Kessel Run. But yeah, it was really good working with him. And just, he's one of those guys who's got an idea and he's like, all right, let's go figure out how to do it. I'm going to sit here and admire an idea for weeks and not actually try something.
Yeah.
Learned a lot from him in that regard.
Love that. He is one of those. So as your experience now, so did you go directly from Kessel Run or the government life to Clarity? Did you take a break in between there? Tell me about now let's talk about your transition as a service member, because a lot of military go through that transition. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. So tell us about your experience.
Yeah. So I went from Kessel Run on to a couple, like two other assignments. And eventually, so the last assignment, we were able to get stationed in Fort Worth, which is a good place for family. And then we were like, all right, it's time to, once we get to Fort Worth, we're planning to stay here as long as we can. So eventually got to the point where it was just like, the career's not going to support staying in one spot forever. So might as well go ahead and make that transition. And I just started reaching out to the network. I posted on LinkedIn with, hey, I'm looking for work. Anybody want to take a chance on this guy? And sure enough, like Matt Nelson again comes into the picture. So he's worked a lot with Clarity through Bespin, which is the main customer I support. And he was also hit up by Clarity at the same time that I basically sent my resume to Matt and I was like, hey, do you have any good places I could go interview with? And that same day, I think our Clarity leadership hit him up. Hey, do you know anyone that could be an Air Force PM for Bespin? And he's like, oh, let me connect the dots here. And then that's how it works. So it's, you hear it all the time, right? It's not about what you know, it's who you know. And so that was, yeah. And then Matt's one of those guys, like if I got his recommendation, it was pretty much, I was going to have to really booger up the interview to not get picked up for Clarity.
Yeah. Totally. And how's that? What was that experience like for you personally? So going from military life to civilian life?
Yeah. From a work perspective, it's been weird not being in all the conversations. Like I remember, especially in the acquisition community, there would be these times where we'd be like, all right, we need to have a government discussion. And then the contractors would leave the room, but I was still there. Now, obviously I'm not. So it's a different vibe, right? And learning how to affect change without being the actual person who can make an official decision, which I think it's similar to my past life as a maintenance officer, because a lot of times you're working for someone who makes the final call and then you're providing recommendations to them. You're not really, until you get up to be a squadron commander as an aircraft maintenance officer, you're not really the one making the final decision on a lot of things. So you have to kind of learn how to do that already. And I think that has made it easier to transition to being a contractor, because it's all about what, like how much rapport can you build up? And then I think another just really interesting aspect is I have this team that's with me wherever, like we go, we have a customer that has a different need than what I specifically am working on my program. There's other people in Clarity that I can reach out to and be like, hey, we need to have a conversation about zero trust architecture at the edge. And I say, hey, Trevor, who could I bring into this discussion? And there's five names that pop up and I bring those guys in and it feels instantly, okay, we're all Clarity. We're all here to help. So that is a really cool vibe that I'm used to having to some extent at the military, but I think this, it recreates that somewhat, which has been really neat.
And Clarity itself has a lot of veterans too, does it not?
Yeah, it does. So that helps too.
That's awesome, man. I love seeing that you're able to turn that military career into something, because you see too often, especially as I come from the dirty enlisted side, there's so many that don't have that opportunity. They do the job, they do an amazing job in the service, but doesn't translate, or it doesn't matter. They just don't find that. So I love talking to people like yourself that have been able to apply what you've done from military to civilian life. And so I'll ask my next question is, what are a couple of things that stand out that like you apply in your daily work, your monthly work that came from your military career?
I think the first on the list is show up with not trying to cuss on the show, but show up with some drive to get stuff done, right? Don't just show up to collect a paycheck. And I think that's something that a lot of military guys get innately, which is why a lot of companies want to hire veterans, because typically you show up and you want to get stuff done. And I think that's step one. If you have motivation, that'll take you a lot further than talent ever by itself ever would. So I think that's step one, is just care about what you do and then take ownership over it. Like, I've rarely, as a maintenance officer, would you go to the pilot and say, hey, the plane's not ready, but it's someone else's fault. Like, you just go with them and explain, look, this plane's not ready yet. We're waiting on a part. We've already done everything we can to expedite it. It's going to be here this time, and it's going to take us 12 hours to replace it, and we'll have you ready. Like, you don't go up to them and say, so-and-so failed to put the right priority shipping on it. It just doesn't fly. And I think that's the same thing that folks are looking for in any kind of manager, is within your, or leader, within your span of control, own what's going on, and don't show up with excuses. Show up with plans of how you're going to fix stuff. And then I think another piece is communication. Like, communication is an art form. It's certainly not a science, in my opinion. And a lot of it has to do with just understanding, first of all, what are your boss's priorities, and then what are the things that you're going to get schwacked for if you don't let them know about. And I've had a couple instances at Clarity where I've missed and I haven't been schwacked. It's like, hey, by the way, next time, please. Nothing like in maintenance where I'll get my head ripped off. It's, you got to learn your boss, and you got to learn what those lanes are. And I think a good rule is just over communicate until people tell you to shut up. And then you're like, okay, so I can scale that back a little bit. Trying to over communicate is always a good place to start. And then you eventually figure out, okay, that's really not something this person needs to know about, or at least not that level. Bill.
That's fantastic. I asked for three lessons and you gave me three pieces of advice for everybody who's listening. So I think that's great. What's that?
I said I lost Kim. Sorry if I.
No, wait. Keep going, man. Like, you keep throwing knowledge. This is about me. This is about you. They're coming to listen to what you have. They have to learn from you, which is leading me to another question. So you went from that executive level, doing paperwork, approving things, signing off on stuff, to that innovation level. And was that easy? Was that fun? Like, tell us a little bit more about that piece of it.
Yeah, I think it was easy in the sense that the projects gradually. So we were able to, between me and Matt, we were able to stay ahead of things for a while. I think the challenge was just figuring out how to make stuff happen at our level. Cause I was used to, I would call like a 3-star's office and be like, hey, want the meeting? Can we get it scheduled? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I can have that meeting. And if I called up as just regular old Captain Humphreys and try to like set up a meeting with the 3-star, they'd be like, okay, thank you very much. Maybe you need to go see mental health. Like, what are you doing here? So like, how do you get stuff done when you're not a big wing? And that was, I think, something that took some figuring out. But what I started to realize was, if you can think of each organization as this pyramid, and you've got a lot of lower level people, like at the captain and lieutenant level, who are getting stuff done, and then you've got fewer people at the major lieutenant colonel of 6th level, and then you got even fewer people up at the general level, and you've got those same pyramids recreated across like we'll just call it like the mission world, where things are actually getting done and people are actually executing the mission. and then the requirements world where people are managing the funding and the requirements for acquisition of people or of stuff for the mission people to execute. And then you have the acquisition world with another pyramid, which is managing all the programs that go into that. And then another pyramid is the contract world where you have people like me now who are actually, and you who are actually building and delivering the thing. And so at each level of the organization, like you really want the CEO and the PEO and the 4-star MAGCOM commander to be talking to each other and know what's happening. But those guys only talk like once a month, if that, and they're talking about 1,000 different things that could be on their plate. So like only at the captain level or the lieutenant level, do you have the bandwidth to have a 3-hour conversation as an acquisition guy with someone who's doing the mission day to day and really understand what those requirements are with the person who's on staff. Like those, that level of conversation can only happen at the lower level of the organization because we have the time available and we're close enough and have the expertise to address it. And so just that whole concept of this connective tissue that sort of reaches out across the pyramid layers. And that is how, as a brand new lieutenant, like you can affect change because not because you have a lot on the collar, but because you have access to other people who are also able to access decision makers at any given time.
All that from my Marine Corps brain goes to that small unit leadership. Just somebody that's trained immediately for running every service, that every team can lead and every team can operate and do that thing. And then you all kind of work together. That's great. Is there another piece where, so as you kind of start becoming into the innovation world, a word that I think is way overused.
Yeah.
You recently heard my podcast with Michaela. I got my innovation hair gel in.
That's right.
Keeps my hair nice and innovative.
Yeah.
Helps me slice through bureaucracy with it.
That's right.
But from your perspective, like how can people that are trying to get into this world or experience roadblocks or things in the innovation side, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah. One thing I would say is, and you touched on this really well, Matt, when you were talking with Michaela about the thing you got known for initially, right? What was it called? One day procurement. One day procurement. Is that you didn't try to completely slash the system and throw it to the side, but you were working within the system to change the system. And this is, so after Kessel Run, I went back to the maintenance world on the F-35 as a user for a little while. And I had all these frustrations like, oh, why can't we get parts? Why can't we do X, Y, Z? And then I was graced with my last assignment in the Air Force was on the program side of the F-35. And I got to be part of all those conversations of why not. And the answers were actually really good. And I was like, wow, this makes a ton of sense. But what I started to realize was this was a new program and the rules that are in place right now were designed by someone. And it's not that's necessarily the best way to do it, but that is the way that's been set for now. And when you're talking about a program of 300 airplanes, it's a lot easier to shift things. Once you get to 1,000 airplanes or 1,500 or 2,000, 10,000. Now every shift, it's like you go from driving a jet ski to driving a yacht or like an ocean liner. And so change is going to take a while to be effective. And number one, I think you work with a system to change the system. Number two is have patience with it and have tenacity, because sometimes you're going to have to ask or suggest the same thing multiple times. And number three is understand that like bureaucracy is not necessarily our enemy. I think a lot of innovators look at bureaucracy as if it's the worst thing ever. Someone in the world needs to be responsible for making sure we don't all just run into a bomb dump with a live grenade. Like there are certain reasons that rules are in place, and it's especially within the DoD space where you're talking about taxpayer dollars and sometimes lives that can be at stake. Bureaucracy is there often to help us, to keep us safe or to make sure we're responsible with funding, whatever it might be. It's not something that we need to look at as the enemy. We need to understand, okay, how can we work with it and how can we adjust things to better serve our needs? And I think a lot of that comes down to, like I was saying, you work across, if you're an OIC of a maintenance unit and you're on the mission pyramid somewhere, get to know the guy who's at Air Combat Command Logistics A4 who works the requirements piece and works on the policy for whatever premises you own, and talk to that guy about how you can change the policy. And sometimes that's all you got to do. But the other piece is know who your puppet is. And I don't mean to be disrespectful with this, but I've had a colonel in the past who told me, like, hey, I'm your puppet. You know what's going on the flight line better than I do. Use me. Use me as your voice. Use me as your puppet. And that's what you got to do, is you got to be able to communicate what is the issue, really identify what the problem is or what the gain is that you're trying to achieve. And root cause analysis, the heck out of it. So you really understand what the problem is. And then what's the cost of that issue, or what's the potential benefit? And be able to put it in terms that make sense. Man hours or flight hours or cost per flying hour or whatever it is. And then, or aircraft downtime. And then how should it be fixed? Those kind of three key pieces, then you can fire across your network, and you fire up through higher levels in the pyramid by using the closest puppet to you, right?
Yeah, I absolutely love that reference. I think that's a sign of a great leader, is that just says, point me in the direction you need me to go, and get things out of your way, then do stuff. So this is the favorite part of my show, is I'm not going to ask questions. Now my last thing is, this is your chance to share anything that we didn't talk about, anything else you want to say. Say hi to your dog. Your kids probably won't listen to it because you're dad, and they don't think dad does. But what else,
anything
else you want to
hit? I would not be the first one to say that the spouse is critical in the military. You know, if the military member is married, and especially if there are kids involved, the spouse is huge. You know, my wife, Kristen, has been amazing from when we got married back in 2010 to spending 3 months with me in lovely Wichita Falls, including the hottest part of the year, which is plus 100. For most of it. And then overseas, dealing with that struggle for the first year and a half that we were over in Italy. And then, just the whole time, Kristen has been amazing. And I probably wouldn't have kids if it wasn't for Kristen, because I'd be too scared. But so I can blame that on her, but it was a joint decision, I promise. But just like, having someone to come home to, forcing work-life balance, right? Because if I had stayed at work all the time, I'd be shortchanging her. And I'm sure I still did that a lot anyway. Just keeping me healthy overall, and then helping with all the moves and a sounding board to talk through things that are going on at work. So I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to her.
Go, Kristen.
Well, that's right.
That's awesome. Brian, I love your journey. That's why I want to have you on here. So thank you for telling your story, your lessons. You made it hard for our team, because you gave me like 50 different great quotes to use for some awesome advice. So I really appreciate you coming on, man.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Matt. I really appreciate it. Good talk.
Hey, you too. And anyone else, if you're still listening, thanks for joining. Subscribe. If you want to reach Brian, let me know. I'll put you in contact with him if you can't find him. Otherwise, be awesome and be the reason someone has an awesome day. We'll see you next time.